It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show,
we have created a provision under the law to enable patients that have that situation to say, when it happens, I want you to honor my documented wish, and I want you to ignore my protest. And you'll hear us and others talk about this as a Ulysses provision, or Ulysses clause. Hopefully you own the mythology. Ulysses asked to be tied to the mast of his ship. He plugged the ears of the rest of the sailors with wax, and he said, no matter what I do, don't untie me as we sail past the sirens. That's the concept here.
Private attorney Nathan Kottkamp explains changes to the law of advance directives in the second of a two-part broadcast of a presentation given on April 26, 2010, at a conference on guardianship, elder rights, and disability services sponsored by the Virginia Guardianship Association and the Virginia Elder Rights Coalition. And this week's News You Can Use spotlights the growing problem of unregulated work that leads to wage theft. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 90, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR, 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. In industries ranging from construction and food manufacturing to grocery stores, restaurants, janitorial services, and home health care, new forms of work organization have generated labor practices that are effectively beyond the reach of government regulation, sometimes called unregulated work. In these jobs, workers routinely face violations of minimum wage and overtime laws, unsafe working conditions, discrimination, and retaliation for speaking up or trying to organize. But a new report released last month by the National Employment Law Project outlines how the Obama administration can combat the epidemic of illegal pay practices that is hurting millions of workers. The report, titled Just Pay, Improving Wage and Hour Enforcement at the U.S. Department of Labor, represents a year-long effort to devise concrete reform proposals to help the U.S. Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division enforce and strengthen the laws that govern the American workplace. The paper follows other reports about the severity of workplace violations and the inadequacies of enforcement. Last fall, a groundbreaking study of low-wage industries in the three largest U.S. cities revealed that 26% of surveyed workers were paid less than the minimum wage, and 76% were not properly paid for overtime. The average worker lost over $2,600 in annual income as a result of the violations. Compounding the problem of employer noncompliance, studies by the Government Accountability Office at the end of the Bush administration blasted the Wage and Hour Division for failing to enforce basic minimum wage and overtime laws. In 1998, for example, the Wage and Hour Division pursued claims filed by more than 35,000 workers and initiated an additional 16,000. By 2007, the agency pursued only 22,000 workers' complaints, more than a third fewer than 1998, and initiated only 7,000 claims on its own, fewer than half of 1998's claims. When the GAO sent undercover wage claimants to the Wage and Hour Division, they were met with unreturned calls, consistent case closings, and confusing or non-existent communications. The full report is available at www.nelp.org and clicking the publications link. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for the answer to our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? Last week, we gave you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which was incorrect. Here's last week's question. Medicaid benefits, a government health insurance, are available to which two groups of low-income people? A. The elderly. B. People who are temporarily or permanently disabled. Or C. Children, their caretakers, and pregnant women. The correct answers are A. The elderly, and C. Children, their caretakers, and pregnant women. Although some people who are permanently disabled can get Medicaid, people who are temporarily disabled generally cannot. Later in the show, we'll give you this week's quiz. Is that legal? For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault.
On April 26, 2010, private attorney Nathan Kottkamp spoke at a conference sponsored by the Virginia Guardianship Association and the Virginia Elder Rights Coalition on guardianship, elder rights, and disability services. He spoke about changes to the law of advance directives, and Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show was there. Here's the second part of this two-part talk.
If you're an agent, either by being named in an advance directive or by one of these default rules, you need to be making sure that you're making decisions consistent with any known wishes of the individual, and certainly consistent with a written advance directive if one exists. One note, it's letter B there, and you'll notice that this is not a change to the law. It's not in italics. But decision makers who are authorized to make decisions under the default rules are not authorized under Virginia law to restrict visitation. And we see this happen all the time. Patient ends up in a hospital unexpectedly, and there is strife within the family, and the person who is authorized as the decision-making agent says, I don't want the other people, the other family members, the girlfriend, the boyfriend, whoever it is, I don't want them visiting my loved one in the hospital. For better or for worse, like it or not, the law says that unless you've given authority to someone to restrict visitation, the presumption is that those that, consistent with healthcare facility policies, we don't have disruptive visitors and things like that, but anyone should be authorized to visit people that are in the hospital. If you got someone that's being disruptive, nearly every healthcare facility that I know of has a visitation policy. You don't get carte blanche to be a pest, to be disruptive, to be dangerous to either the patient or staff members. So consult somebody with the facility. Get a social worker involved. Get administration involved, and it may be that there is some sort of restriction that could be placed there. Otherwise, I would imagine that if you're really having a problem with visitation, there's nothing restricting someone from going to a court and saying, I want to get a protective order. And that's, you would deal with that in the normal mechanism of protective order. The next provisions that we're going to talk about are not only the most potentially complex, but they are, aside from the fact that we've expanded advance directives in Virginia to cover all forms of care, are the most revolutionary, if you will, of the changes from 2009. What we have done is to create two mechanisms for dealing with a problem that happens most often in the mental health situation, but sometimes in just the dementia, Alzheimer's situation. That has to do with patient protest. You can have a patient who is incapable of making informed decisions who nevertheless is telling you, no, don't do certain things. And under the prior law, the pre-2009 law, a provider's hands were essentially tied because the law said you have to honor the protest of a patient. If they say no to something, you had to honor it regardless of whether the patient has the wherewithal to know the meaning of what they're really protesting. I've got a 3-year-old daughter. She gets shots routinely, and she always says no. She's going to get the damn shot, all right? There are plenty of patients who need certain basic fundamental care. They're going to tell you no, and they need that care. Now, what we've done is we've addressed two different scenarios, two different branches of when the patient protest happens. One is the situation of the patient who knows that they're going to protest or thinks that they're going to protest. And again, this is mostly limited to the mental health population. It could be the dementia and Alzheimer's population, but it is probably the mental health population. This is the patient who has some sort of lifelong mental health condition that is periodic, episodic, and very, very similar every time it happens. And what they know from past experience is, when I'm having my acute event, I'm going to tell you no to the following things, but at the end of the day, when it's been ordered by a court and it ended up working, I realized that's exactly what I need to get myself straight again. So we have created a provision under the law to enable patients that have that situation to say, when it happens, I want you to honor my documented wish, and I want you to ignore my protest. And you'll hear us and others talk about this as a Ulysses provision, or Ulysses clause. Hopefully you own the mythology. Ulysses asked to be tied to the mast of his ship. He plugged the ears of the rest of the sailors with wax, and he said, no matter what I do, don't untie me as we sail past the sirens. That's the concept here. There are, however, because this is such a profoundly, this is a powerful provision under the law, we've placed some very strict limitations on its use and its application. And first of that is that it cannot apply to the withholding of life-prolonging procedures. Anytime someone says, keep me alive, you do it. Simple enough, okay? That's just fundamental under the law. Second is the advance directive needs to expressly state what it is that the person is wanting. So again, this goes back to that patient who really knows themselves. This is the type of thing that hopefully is going to be done in a session with a psychiatrist or psychologist or someone that really knows, and we're talking about plans of care, things like that. As a consequence of that, these provisions must be signed by a physician who states the patient understands what it is that they are locking themselves into. Now again, going back to those requirements under the law and what I talked about earlier, a physician does not need to sign an advance directive generally. However, for one of these Ulysses clauses to be effective, it must be signed by a physician. If someone attempts to create a Ulysses clause and doesn't get it signed by their physician, the rest of the document, if it's got two witnesses, is still valid. But the protest provision is not. And ultimately, when it comes time to implement these provisions, the physician needs to determine and document that the healthcare is medically appropriate and ethically appropriate.
You're listening to a talk given on April 26, 2010 by private attorney Nathan Kottkamp about changes to the law of advance directives at a conference on guardianship, elder rights, and disability services sponsored by the Virginia Guardianship Association and the Virginia Elder Rights Coalition. We'll be back in a moment. If you're just joining us, the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show now rejoins private attorney Nathan Kottkamp in a talk about changes to the law of advance directives given on April 26, 2010 at a conference sponsored by the Virginia Guardianship Association and the Virginia Elder Rights Coalition on guardianship, elder rights, and disability services.
The other key provision with respect to protest is, again, probably the more common of situations in that you've now got a patient who is protesting, saying no to something that is probably not meaningful, but there's no advance directive. They didn't go through a Ulysses Clause. This is kind of akin to my daughter and her shot situation, is the patient who doesn't understand and is just simply saying, no, don't clean my ulcer. No, don't give me antibiotics. No, just is saying no to everything, and it's not, it doesn't make sense, and we recognize that it doesn't make sense. An agent may, not must, make decisions over a patient's protest. If it's not an end-of-life decision-making situation, it's not a mental health admission situation, it's the decision is based on the known wishes of the patient or best interest standards. The physician also determines that it's medically and ethically appropriate. And finally, it is confirmed as being acceptable by that committee of the facility or two physicians who are uninvolved in the patient's care. Last thing I'll note on this protest provision is you can have a Ulysses Clause on an agent. You can say, I want to lock myself into having a certain person be my decision maker, even in the event of protest. You can imagine the mental health patient who has a loving and devoted spouse who, when they have their episode, says, I don't want that person anywhere near me, not making decisions. And meanwhile, that is really the very best person for them. They know their care. So you can lock yourself into an agent, as with some other provisions. All right, I'm going to really romp through the rest of this pretty darn fast. Again, most of the remaining provisions are not changes to the law. Transfer in the event that you've got a refusal by a physician. If physicians don't want to honor advance directive choices, they need to transfer a patient. They get about 14 days to do so. Durable do not resuscitate orders. These are documents that say do not provide CPR. Either inside or outside a facility. We've expanded the law in 2009 and then again in 2010 to cover just about any healthcare facility, and now also continuing care retirement communities where there was a gap in the law there. Immunity from liability, I'll simply note that we've expanded this to cover what we think were some gaps in the law. Also, that those serving on a patient care consulting committee will have immunity as long as they're acting in faith. Willful destruction, this has been expanded. Concealment penalties and things, the penalties for forging and things like that have been expanded to encompass the new provisions of the law, but it's always been a crime to modify or withhold advance directive information. Failure to deliver an advance directive, this is essentially what do you do if you just don't know the document is out there. Medically unnecessary care, you'll see at the top of the next page, and mercy killing, euthanasia prohibited, no change to the law here, that's still a fundamental tenet of Virginia law. Effective a declaration, suicide, hopefully this is long gone, but one of the original concerns about advance directives is that if you say, I don't want life prolonging procedures, your life insurance is going to say, well, you've committed suicide, you've voided your policy. Wrong answer, not the case under Virginia law. Preservation of existing rights, this is an important one, and it states that the Healthcare Decisions Act provisions are cumulative with the rest of the law. So, for example, those TDOs and other provisions related to mental health and other laws, they still apply, and that these laws supplement those. Reciprocity, this is a key one as well. Advance directives executed in another state, if they were executed under the law of the state where it came in from, if it meets that law's requirements, we will honor it in Virginia, even if it doesn't meet the other state's law. Best examples is North Carolina needs to be notarized for North Carolina advance directive. If it nevertheless has two witnesses, it's valid in Virginia if it meets Virginia's law. So keep that in mind as far as reciprocity. And then finally, there were some changes in 2009, this is page 12, on mental health admissions. Advance directives can authorize admission into a mental health facility for a period of up to 10 days. After 10 days, the mental health, the patient rights, human rights regulations kick in. You need to have a hearing to determine whether or not the patient needs to have more prolonged admission into a mental health facility, but that's an important change to the law as well. The last thing I'll note before turning it back over to Susan is there was mentioned National Healthcare Decisions Day. Hopefully you all knew about that event. It was April 16. If for some reason you're sitting in this room and you've not been getting monthly emails from me on the 16th of every month, you know that you are not on my distribution list. If you want to be updated, and particularly one of the things I do is I send supplemental emails to anybody that's in Virginia, go on to nationalhealthcaredecisionsday.org, and there's a button that says Join Us. Please go out there. Join us on April 16th. But that's also one of the best ways that you can ensure that for additional changes to Virginia law that you're kept up to date, because I will continue to provide updates for everybody there.
You've been listening to the second of a two-part talk given on April 26, 2010 by private attorney Nathan Kottkamp about changes to the law of advance directives at a conference on guardianship, elder rights, and disability services sponsored by the Virginia Guardianship Association and the Virginia Elder Rights Coalition. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for our weekly quiz call. Is that legal? We give you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which is incorrect, and we give the correct answers next week. If you're the first to email the two correct answers, we'll post your name on our show's website and send you a free copy of the Virginia State Bar's Handbook on Your Legal Rights and Responsibilities. Here's this week's question. Which two types of bad credit information can be kept on your credit report? A bankruptcy that is 8 years old. B, a judgment that is 8 years old, or C, a past due debt that is 6 years old. If you know the two correct answers, email them by Friday to marty@cvlas.org and be next week's winner. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. You can get free legal information at the statewide legal aid website. This is www.valegalaid.org. You also may get free pre-recorded legal information by phone during non-business hours. These are before 9 a.m., after 5 p.m., and on weekends and legal holidays. Call toll-free 1-866-534-5243. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This spring, the General Assembly finally regulated a predatory lending industry that previously was totally unregulated. Join us next week when Dana Wiggins, Responsible Lending Coordinator at the Virginia Poverty Law Center, explains what to watch and what to watch out for when the new car title lending law takes effect later this year. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegebrecht.